This is Jack's Journal, an in-depth look at issues that affect you and your community.
Hello and welcome to Jack's Journal here on 104.5 WOKV. So hopefully by now you're able to work from home, or maybe you're even staying at home at your place and practicing social distancing due to this coronavirus outbreak that we are experiencing here in Northeast Florida. Well, that presents potentially life-threatening consequences for domestic violence survivors here in our area. So today we're going to talk with Dr. Gail Patton to discuss these issues and create awareness. Doctor, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, and I really appreciate you taking the opportunity to get this message out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And my first question, how does the COVID-19 situation that's going on across the United States, and more specifically here in Northeast Florida, have an impact on domestic violence survivors?
Well, as we know, the situation is dire for everybody. But layered on top of that, for victims of domestic violence and their children, they have other concerns that are real and can be life-threatening as well. So we're living in a time where people are encouraged to self-isolate. And what that does is that increases the amount of access an abuser has to their victims, while at the same time decreasing the amount of access that survivors have for help. So, for instance, when we're not in this type of situation, survivors may be leaving their house to go to work or to go see a friend or to tell the abuser that they're going to the library. And in those instances, they may reach out to people for help with their situation. Right now, they don't have that opportunity. So while they are in closer proximity for longer periods of times with the abusers, they don't have the same ability to get out to seek help like they did previously. And so we're looking at a situation where survivors are really in jeopardy for not having access as readily as they normally would. And that really concerns me, because we're talking about a situation that is already stressful and that is already hard for everybody. In homes where there is violence, that increases the risk to survivors and their children.
Now, my follow-up question to this is, what is Hubbard House doing to be more accessible, if that's the case, or help these domestic violence survivors out?
Well, first of all, I want all survivors listening to this to know that they are not alone. Hubbard House, as well as throughout the state, have 24/7 hotline, and that really is the main point of contact right now. If you can talk safely on the phone, call the hotline and let the person on the other end of the line know what is going on, so they can help plan with you your best situation in this situation. And it's going to be different for everybody else, because everybody's situation is different. But if you call that hotline, staff will safety plan with you. For those that it's necessary to seek shelter elsewhere, then they can work with you on that, because that will have to be done a little differently if the abuser is home 24/7. And it will also just provide that other voice on the end of the line who will believe you, who will support you, and who will help you come to decisions for you and your family.
Now, with this subject, I mean, the last time that we talked, we talked about broader concepts about why having domestic violence awareness is important. So to kind of reiterate that this time, I just want you to talk a little bit about why having this awareness and having this idea out there for people to think about, something that they might not necessarily think about with the coronavirus situation, the COVID-19 situation that's going on. Why is it important to have this information out there for people to think about?
Well, this information can literally save lives. So there are people out there who aren't victims of domestic violence, but they might know somebody. And they might understand that that person is having a little more difficulty getting and seeking help. So just being aware of your surroundings, aware of the people in your sphere of influence. You know, we're doing a lot of connecting through social media. And so if somebody you know through your conversations on the phone or through your Facebook, if if somebody you know starts talking about a situation that sounds like it's domestic violence, give them our hotline number, because that could literally be their lifeline. It's important to know, too, for when the immediacy of this crisis passes, and of course we don't know when that will be. You know, we hear estimates from a month to 2 to 3 months, but when people are finally able to leave their homes or get out more, then we anticipate that most domestic violence centers around the nation will see an increase of people reaching out for help, because for some people, it may be the first time they were able to get out and get help.
Now, that kind of makes me think of another interesting tidbit that I was thinking about. So a few days ago, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry, during one of his press conferences, mentioned the fact that people should take time out of their day to stay connected to loved ones, just call them and talk about something other than what's going on right now with this coronavirus situation, whether that may be a fond memory or something that they have planned together, or maybe some sort of sporting event that they might be planning on, or whatever the case may be. So I wanted to ask you, how important is it for people to stay connected on a regular basis for people that they might suspect are domestic violence survivors?
I think it is incredibly important, and I just want to give a shout out to Mayor Curry and his staff, because they have been showing amazing leadership and have been working with us as well as other homeless shelters in the area to address this issue. As I mentioned previously, that idea of staying connected, even if it's on the phone or through other social media venues, is very important, because at least that person will have somebody to talk to. At least they may have somebody to brainstorm with, and that person can give our hotline number as well in case that person they're talking to doesn't have it. Now, a survivor can also go to our website at hubbardhouse.org to look at safety planning tips, but I would caution that if they do that, they need to do it when the abuser is not around, and they need to erase all history so that the abuser can't go on and see what they've been looking at on the websites.
Right now, we are talking with Dr. Gail Patton with Hubbard House here in Jacksonville. We are talking about the situation that domestic violence survivors face right now with these issues and orders in place to really stay home, and how they can kind of overcome that. So just a few moments ago, you mentioned the phone number. I want to make sure that if you're able to do so, give that phone number out.
Yes, so the local number for Duval County and Baker County is 904-354-3114. The state number is 1-800-500-1119. And when you call that state number, it should connect you with your local domestic violence center.
Earlier, Gail, you were talking about how Hubbard House and other shelters are expecting to see an increase of people once these shelter-in-place orders or these stay-at-home orders are released, and we kind of get back to a somewhat normal social life. So I have to ask, how is there a number that y'all are expecting, or is it just an increase of people that are expected to come no matter what?
Well, obviously, we don't have a definitive number because this type of crisis is unprecedented. But what we do know is in situations where we have had people isolate together for hurricanes, which is for a really brief period of time, that we have seen an increase. So we can only anticipate that that will happen after this is finished, and that it will happen at greater numbers because people are being isolated longer.
Right. Absolutely. Another thing in the release that I just saw that I thought was very important to kind of get out there, and maybe you could talk more about this. How important is it to keep a cell phone charged at all times for survivors?
Well, that's absolutely important because, as I said, the phone may be their literal lifeline. So So making sure that you keep that plugged in and charged up and to pay attention to that, because we are connecting more on the phones, which is good to stay connected, but we may be using our battery quicker than normal. So yes, absolutely pay attention to that and keep your cell phone charged.
Right. And there's also no shutoff orders for utilities as well. I believe JEA is one of those utility companies that is not shutting off power for non-payment at this time. So being able to have a charger plugged into the wall and charging your cell phone is very important, Doctor. So we just have a few more moments here on Jack's Journal, Doctor, and I wanted to give you the final word. What is it that people that are listening to this program need to take away and kind of think about on their in their day-to-day lives as normal as we are trying to be in this situation? What are some of the things that they need to keep in mind if they're a survivor, or if they are also if they might know someone who might be a survivor?
I would want people to know that during this time that there are people in homes that are facing life-threatening situations, and whether you know that a person in that situation or whether you are that person in the situation, these people are not alone, and there are options. Immediate danger, call 911. Other than that, give them our 24-hour hotline and let them make a call, because we are here on the other end of that line to do whatever we can do to help during this crisis, and we will help people work through their particular situation to come out with the best outcome possible during this crisis.
Doctor, thank you so much again for taking time out of your day to talk about this very serious subject with us. And, you know, I was talking to someone just the other day, and it was an idea that and it was a situation that I was kind of wondering about. So I'm very glad that Hubbard House is taking time out of the day to kind of get this word out there, and also you for taking time out of your day to talk with us. So I really, really appreciate it.
You are welcome, and really thank you. You getting this information out is truly going to save lives.
Thanks for listening to Jack's Journal here on 104.5 WOKV. Now we're going to switch gears and talk about the Bright Future Scholarship with the Associate Director of Financial Aid at the University of North Florida, Marla Lewis. Today we're going to talk about what it takes to get and maintain that scholarship. Now it's something that you probably heard of, or maybe your kids are trying to get so that way they can go to school. And Marla is here today to talk a little bit more about that. So Marla, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Stephen.
Thank you for being on the show. So let's start out with a very broad topic. What is Bright Futures in a 30,000-foot view sense?
Sure. Well, Bright Futures is a state scholarship. It is a merit-based scholarship, and it is funded through the lottery.
Now, that kind of brings me to my next question, was where does that money come from? And you said it was from the Florida Lottery, correct?
That is correct, yes.
So over the course of the year, how many scholarships are paid out given to students at the University of North Florida?
Well, we have over 3,500 students who receive this scholarship. This scholarship is dispersed. You can get it in fall and in spring. And you also can have this scholarship for summer, especially for those incoming freshmen, those students who are newly earning the scholarship. This is a great opportunity to use those funds early.
Now, earlier you were talking about merit. It's merit-based. So I have to ask, what are the merits and some of the standards that the students have to attain in order to get this scholarship?
Sure. The two primary levels of Bright Futures are the Bright Futures Academic Scholarship and the Medallion Scholarship, and they each have different eligibility requirements and different renewal requirements, because once you've got it, you want to make sure that you keep it. The eligibility for the academic level, you need a 3.5 GPA, and you need corresponding test scores. The test scores for the academic are 29 ACT and a 1290 SAT. In addition to both that GPA and the test score, you also need community service hours, and the academic level requires 100 community service hours. Medallion level, you need a 3.0, the ACT is a 26, and the SAT is 1170. And then that medallion level requires 75 community service hours.
Now, whenever we talk about money, you mentioned earlier that it's funded by the Florida Lottery. Now, is it solely funded by the Florida Lottery, or are there other outside entities putting money into the Bright Futures Scholarship?
It's my understanding this is solely funded by the lottery.
Gotcha. Okay. So earlier you were just mentioning students would want to keep the scholarship. So what is it that students have to do in order to keep that scholarship once they receive it?
Exactly. So students have to maintain a GPA of 3.0 for that academic level, and this is after the fall and spring term. And they need to maintain a 2.75 for that medallion level to be able to renew it for the next year. Now, let's say you have that freshman, and maybe there's been a little bit of a struggle. It's a huge learning curve. And maybe that GPA doesn't quite meet those renewal requirements. As a freshman, for that summer semester, they can take summer coursework to increase that GPA.
Now, whenever we talk about these scholarships, obviously there's a monetary benefit to them. But is it possible to talk a little bit about, how does the Bright Futures Scholarship help students besides just lifting a financial burden off of their shoulders? What are some of the ripple effects of getting this scholarship for students that you've seen?
Well, I think it's primarily financial. You know, if you're not worried about that money, then you have the opportunity, maybe you don't have to have that part-time job. Maybe you have the opportunity to focus a little bit more on your academics. So maybe your academics are higher. You do better in school, then you can have that better job when you're ready to graduate. And then I also wanted to say, Stephen, when I said before about students and their renewal, I want to just say that at the end of the spring term, if they haven't met that GPA for renewal, that they can take summer coursework and increase that GPA, but that's only an option after their freshman year.
Now, since it's only an option after their freshman year, is there anything that students can do after their freshman in order to, try to keep that GPA up?
Yes, so that gets a little bit trickier. So let's say if you are at the academic level and you don't meet the 3.0 GPA, but you do meet that 2.75. So maybe you renew at the lower level and then you do your sophomore year at the medallion level. If your GPA comes up, then you can reinstate back into the academic level. So let's say now you're at the medallion level and you don't meet that 2.75. You can take the next year without being eligible for Bright Futures. If you increase your GPA once you sit out for that year, you may have the opportunity to reinstate. So Bright Futures has an interactive tool on their website, and that website is floridastudentfinancialaid.org. And you can see once you put in your GPA and the credits you've attempted, it'll walk you through whether or not you're eligible again.
And this, going back earlier, Bright Futures is only available for public universities in the state of Florida, correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. And it's not only the university, it's any school within that state university system. So state college level also participates in Bright Futures, but Bright Futures Scholarship will disperse at different amounts, a little bit higher at the university, a little bit lower at the state college.
Makes sense, since universities have a higher credit hour It costs
Correct.
More.
A little bit more expensive,
yeah,
right?
They, yeah, you need to have the money. So going back to private schools, is there any sort of funding that students can get at a private school from the state to help them go to a private university?
Right. So I couldn't really talk to private schools. I think different schools participate in different programs. But I will say that even if your student does not think that they're eligible for Bright Futures, they should still complete the application at floridastudentfinancialaid.org, because the state of Florida does have other grants and scholarships available to students in addition to Bright Futures. So this is really all about giving your student opportunities for to access that money.
That's a great point. So obviously we have this coronavirus that's been going around. Have there been any impacts to the Bright Futures process at UNF that you're aware of based off of what's been going on with COVID-19?
Well, that's not something I can really address today. We're getting new guidance almost daily. So I would encourage, you know, people to go to our website where everything is the most up to date.
And what's that website that people can go to?
UNF.edu.
Perfect. Marla, I want to give you the final word. Is there anything else that parents and students who are trying to get this Bright Future Scholarship need to know about?
Yes. Let me just bring up a few more points. So students have to apply for this scholarship, and the deadline to do that is August 31st of the year they graduate from high school. So if you don't apply, it's not an option. Unlike the FAFSA, this application is once and done. Takes about 10 to 15 minutes to complete, and you only have to do it once. I will also say that high schools send data to the state, their grades, in February and again in July. So students might have that met that eligibility for Bright Futures in February. If so, they can go onto the website. They can see that they have those funds. If they're trying to get that GPA up, or they're retesting, or they're completing those community service hours, they'll be sent again at the end of July. But either way, you need to have applied for it, and you need to make sure that that's complete before August 31st. Guidance is the one that parents and students will work with to submit those community service hours. And I will also say that students can only have one school of choice on the Bright Futures website. So you want to be sure, once the students made that final decision of which school they plan to attend, want to make sure that that matches on the Bright Futures website. And then finally, when students apply to Bright Futures, you want to make sure that you're so careful with that social security number, that date of birth, and that name. You want to make sure you're not using your nickname, and you just want to check all those numbers twice, because the state university system is going to match the enrollment against the master eligibility list for the state, and we're matching using social security number, name, and date of birth. So we have to make sure all that's correct.
All good information, Marla. Thank you so much for joining us today here on Jack's Journal. I really do appreciate you taking time out of your day to give us a breakdown of what it's like and what students and parents need to expect if they're trying to get this this big scholarship.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. That's going to wrap up another episode of Jack's Journal here on 104.5 WOKV. I want to thank both of my guests today, Dr. Gail Patton with Hubbard House and Marla Lewis with UNF. And I want to thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Jack's Journal, a production of News 104.5 WOKV.